now if you talk about it.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, it's time to get this call started. Welcome to the Scarlet Leadership Monthly Lunch and Learn. My name is Tom Parrish, and if you'd like a copy of today's slides, please send me an email at tom@scarletleadership.com. And we'll remind you of this during the call a couple of times, but if you have a question, you can hit *7. And if you're watching the slides online, there's a box there where you can submit your question and then just hit the submit button, and we'll address those along the way. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Joe Scarlet.
Welcome, everybody. We're glad to have you with us again. I want to welcome Marshall Goldsmith with us today. I'll tell you a little bit more about him in a couple of minutes, but we're glad Marshall's with us. We have a little bit of a change in schedule for next month. Our call next month is going to be on November 3rd, which is a Monday. So mark your calendars. It's at the beginning of the month. Our guest speaker will be Doug Stone, who was with us last month. He talked about difficult conversations, for which we had, a record number of people on the call. And so he'll be back with us, and he'll be talking about thank you for the feedback, which is, it may not sound like a great topic, but it's enormous, because when you get feedback, the more effectively you deal with it, the more effectively you can go forward, and you can really make some points at that time when you're receiving feedback. So hope you're with us then, Monday, November 3rd, same time, and you'll see more about that on the emails. Today, interestingly enough, Marshall Goldsmith and Mary Fink are at Monteagle at the retreat for our most recent executive class. So they're with us up there, and Tom Parrish and I are here in Nashville. Today's topic is coaching for behavioral change. As I mentioned, Marshall Goldsmith is with us. Marshall's an expert on the subject. He's a coach to some of the most senior executives in the world. He's the author of many, many books, including two that are my favorites. One is Mojo, and the other, which I think is his best-selling book ever, is What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And that's just that's a fabulous book, and if you haven't already read it, you ought to read it. Marshall has also taught for us in our leadership program since the very beginning, about 7 years ago. So with that, turn it over to those up on the mountain there. Mary Fink, it's all yours.
Thank you, and thank you, Marshall, for being with us. We've had a great morning. We've had some laughs. We've raised some money for some charity and learned a lot. So I'll start with just the most basic question, Marshall, and that is, why does coaching matter?
Well, you know, my mission in coaching is to help successful leaders achieve positive long-term change in behavior for themselves, their people, and their teams. And it's kind of counterintuitive, because why would successful people want to have a coach? Well, if you look at the great tennis players, the great golfers, they all have coaches. So why does coaching matter? My book's title, I think, says it all. What got you here won't get you there. If you don't want to get better, there's no use having a coach. If you're sort of willing to coast and drift along, you don't need a coast. What's good about having a coach, though, is to help people who may already be successful move to the next level. And there's one thing I talk about in my new book. Our environment is going to tend to keep us where we've been. So whatever you are right now is probably a good thing. Most people listening to me are probably, you know, educated, hardworking, good people. You have many things to be proud of, and there's nothing wrong with where you are now. The problem is, do you want to get better? And if you do want to get better, that's where a coach can come in handy, because a coach can help you get confidential feedback, learn what you need to improve, and then work with you. In my own coaching, I don't get paid if my clients don't get better. I work with them for a year, year and a half. They get better, I get paid. They don't get better, it's all free. Joe, are you still on the line?
I'm here. Yes.
Hey, now, you've met many of my clients before. Wonderful people. I've been a coach of the CEO of Walmart and Pfizer and Glaxo and Ford. And you've been to dinner with a bunch of them, the president of the World Bank. What are some of the reflections? What have you learned from being around these people that have all had coaching and got feedback? What are some of the things you've learned by being around them?
Well, you learn by networking and by listening to other people's experiences. And people tell you stories about how this worked and this didn't work, and you continually learn from listening to the stories of other people. By the same token, I share some of my stories at the same time. It's, you know, anybody who's interested in learning and can wind up with some coaching from the outside, it makes all the difference in the world. It just helps propel you forward.
Well, that's one other thing I try to do, and Joe's been to two or three of these, or maybe more of these sessions, is I try to, when I do coaching, not have my clients learn from me so much as they learn from everyone around them, and they also learn from each other. So I have had a lot of various meetings and interactions where they try to help each other. And I think once we get over that judging and get into the helping mode, everybody wins, because instead of judging each other, people are all trying to help each other. So those are some of the reasons why I think coaching is important.
Right. And I want to go back just for a second. You were talking about you don't get paid if they don't get better.
Yes.
And that's not your decision, right?
No.
It's not Marshall saying, I did a great job with this guy, so I'm going to get paid.
No. It's not their decision either.
Right.
I get paid. Typically, my average client has 18 key stakeholders, and we measure long-term improvement of these 18 people over about a year and a half. So the average is 18 months and 18 people. And again, nothing magic about 18. The least I've ever had is 8. The most is 40. But your stakeholders do need to see positive long-term change in order for me to get paid.
Excellent. What do you mean by the challenge of success? It seems to me when we get to be successful, we're there. What's the challenge there?
Well, everything I teach and everything in my book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, actually becomes harder and harder as we become more successful in life. As we become successful, we fall into something called a superstition trap. What is the superstition trap? I behave this way. I am successful. Therefore, I must be successful because I behave this way. Wrong. Everyone that I work with is successful. Everyone behaves the way they behave. And everyone I work with is successful because they do many things right and in spite of doing some things that are stupid. And I've never met anyone who was so wonderful we had nothing on the including me or Joe. We've all got a little something there on that in spite of list. So I think it's very important not to let our success go to our head and not to realize. And also, by the way, the more successful you become, the harder it is to get honest feedback for two reasons. One, we all accept feedback from others as consistent with the way we see ourselves. And the more successful we become, people laugh at our jokes, they act like we're smart. We start feeling better and better about ourselves. It gets harder.
You believe your own press.
It's harder to hear the truth. And the second thing happens is every time we get promoted, we become more powerful. And the more powerful we become, the harder it is to hear the truth because people are afraid of us. One of my coaching clients, retired, and what did he say? That my suggestions become orders. Why? Because what happens is when you get to the top, people don't want to prove you're wrong. And one woman is, I forgot her name, she's writing her PhD study, and she studied CEOs. And she said many times CEOs are seen as out of touch with the workforce. And the attribution is that they're arrogant. She said, well, sometimes it's not that they're arrogant. If you're in a room and everyone in that room nods their head to everything you say and pretends to agree with you, you leave the room thinking they agreed with you. You don't realize that behind your back, they may not agree with you at all. They just do that to your face because they're afraid of you because you're the boss. Well, so when you get successful, pretty much everything I teach in my books doesn't get easier to implement when you get successful. It gets harder. The other thing about successful is the more successful we become, the harder it is to challenge ourselves to get better because it's a lot easier to start coasting and saying, well, I've done this. Now I can just kind of relax and coast. But, Bob Dylan's song has a good quote, he who is not busy being born is busy dying. And if you're not really working on developing and trying to get better, then chances are you won't actually coast. You'll probably actually get worse.
Definitely.
Marshall, one of the things that I found, because I saw exactly the same thing, and I got to the point where whenever I was doing anything, I would be the last person to express my opinion. I would try to draw everybody else out first so that they didn't know what position I necessarily had and I tended to get better feedback that way, but you're absolutely right. The further up the ladder you get, the more people tend to tell you what you want to hear. And if you don't probe and listen carefully and keep your ego in check, you tend to isolate yourself away from the troops. And once you get isolated, people stop talking to you and you stop learning.
That's right. Very good.
No question about it. So we spent a little bit of time this morning talking about the things that leaders should stop doing rather than that what they should start doing. And that's a little bit different than most of the leadership books that we read. It's actually quite liberating if you think about it. But what are, and we can't go through it, there are 20 of them in the book, and I encourage anybody out there that hasn't read the book to read it. It's a really a fine read. But I want to talk about a few of them. So what's behind the whole concept of stop doing rather than start doing?
Well, this is something that Peter Drucker is the world's greatest authority on management, and I had the privilege of spending 50 days with him. I was on his advisory board for 10 years, and he's the guy that gave me that idea. He said, we spend a lot of time helping leaders learn what to do. We don't spend enough time helping leaders learn what to stop. He said, half the leaders I meet, they don't need to learn what to do. They need to learn what to stop. I think it's one reason my book is so popular, because it's different. It gets people to focus not just on the positives, but on what do you need to stop doing?
Exactly.
Which one you want to start with?
Let's start with winning too much, because how could that possibly be a problem?
Well, I was interviewed in the Harvard Business Review and asked a question, what is the number one problem of all the successful people that you work with? And my answer was winning too much. What does that mean? If it's important, we want to win. Meaningful, we want to win. Critical, we want to win. Trivial, we want to win. And not worth it, we want to win anyway. Winners love winning. It is incredibly difficult for smart, successful people not to constantly go through life winning. Now, I'm going to give you a couple of case studies to illustrate my point. Case study number one, you want to go to dinner at restaurant X. Your husband, wife, partner, friend, or significant other wants to go to dinner at restaurant Y. Have a heated argument. You go to restaurant Y. It's not your choice. Food tastes awful and the service is terrible. Option A, critique the food. Point out our partner was wrong. And this mistake could have been avoided had only you listened to me, me, me. Option B, shut up, eat the stupid food, try to enjoy it, and have a nice evening. What would I do? What should I do? In most places, what would I do? Critique the food. What should I do? Shut up. Now, Joe, have you ever critiqued the food before, Joe?
Not recently.
In the past, before attending my course.
When I was young and foolish, I used to critique the food.
Was that a smart thing or a bad idea?
That was a bad idea when I was doing it, and much better when I don't do it.
Much better. So I was teaching my class, and then I got a second one. It's even worse. Case study number two is even worse. As bad as that one is, the next one's worse. You have a hard day at work, a hard day. You go home, your husband, wife, or partner's here. The other person says, I had such a hard day today. I had such a tough day. And if we're not careful, our reply is, you had a hard day. You had a hard day. Do you have any idea what I had to put up with today? You think you had a hard day? We're so competitive, we have to prove we're more miserable than the people we live with. I gave this example at a class at Dartmouth. A young man raised his hand. He said, I did that last week. I asked him, what happened? He said, my wife looked at me. She said, honey, you just think you had a hard day. It's not over.
Absolutely.
Now, I love getting emails. I got an email a few months ago and made my whole week. A gentleman sent me an email and he said, I know you don't remember me. I was in your class at Dartmouth 5 years ago. And he said, I just want to send you an email and say thank you. He said, yesterday my wife called up and was telling me what a hard day she had. I was just getting ready to point out how her problems paled in significance to my own. He said, for some reason, I remembered what you said 5 years ago. And he said, I just listened to my wife, and I said, you know, I love you. Thank you for all the sacrifices you made for our family. And then he said, I went home, and I spent $25, and I bought her some flowers, and I gave her the flowers and said, I love you. He sent me an email. He said, that's the best $25 I ever spent in my life. Thank you. Well, very important. Next time we get in that mode, and I'm going to win and prove I'm right, just take a deep breath and ask a question. Exactly what am I winning here? Why am I winning this battle?
Exactly.
What's the next one?
The next one is adding too much value.
Now, this especially with technical people. Engineers are the worst. I'm young, smart, enthusiastic. I come to you with an idea. You think it's a great idea. Rather than just saying great idea, our natural tendency is to say, oh, that's a nice idea. Why don't you add this to it? The problem is the quality of the idea may go up 5%. My commitment to executing the idea may go down 50%. Now it's no longer my idea. Now it's your idea. Incredibly difficult for smart, successful people not to constantly go through life adding value. And we need to realize the effectiveness of execution is what's the quality of the idea. What's my commitment to make it work? And as my friend JP said, my suggestions tend to become orders. Well, that's when you get into adding too much value. I ask him, what'd you learn from me when I was your coach and helped you? He said, stop and breathe and ask, is it worth it before I discuss anything? Well, you know, if you're at work, before you talk, just breathe. Slow down that 285-mile-an-hour brain and say, is my comment going to add to this person's commitment? If the answer is no, breathe again. Is it worth saying? Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's not. At home, before you speak, breathe. Is my comment going to improve my relationship with this person I love? The answer is no, breathe again. Is it worth saying? If you have to ask at work half the time, it's not worth saying. If you ask at home, it's almost never worth saying. Okay, Mary, what's next?
Next is passing judgment.
Passing too much judgment. Well, very important. Again, I'm going to give you four words that help you be a better coach. Better coach at work, better family member at home. What are these four words? Help more, judge less. In life, we spend way too much time judging what other people are saying, judging them. And instead of saying, let me give you some critique of you, focus in the mirror and say, how can I help this other person as opposed to how can I judge this other person? And also, you know, how can I ask that person to help me rather than how that person judges me? I ask a question in class, and I ask it today, and I've asked it to over 1,000 people. What percent of all interpersonal communication time has been on A, somebody talking about how smart, special, wonderful they are, plus B, people talking about how stupid, inept, or dumb somebody else is? And the average answer in the world is right about 65%. And then I ask people, how many of you feel about as busy today as you ever felt in your lives? And everybody raised their hand. And I say, well, I'm going to give you a productivity enhancement tool. Reduce that number. How much do we learn in life talking about how smart, special, wonderful we are? Zero. How much do we learn talking about how stupid other people are? Zero. How much do we learn listening to that nonsense? Zero. And what percent of all interpersonal communication time is wasted on that? 65. Cut that out. Life is much more productive, much more positive, and people are a lot happier.
Joe, do you want to weigh in on that?
No, not right this second.
See, you didn't add too much value. That's good, Joe.
That was the right answer. And it was a trick question. So, knowing all this other stuff, what can I do? Because you talk about in your book, I can develop myself. There's some things I can do to develop my own self. What are they?
Well, the first tip is get in the habit of asking questions. That's a question we in life don't ask enough. What is that question? How can I be a better? How can I be a better friend, a better partner, better boss, better team member? Everybody talks about the value of asking for input, yet we don't ask. Now, all you listening to me right now, I'm going to ask you to get out your cell phone. I'm going to ask you to send a text to that husband, wife, or partner that you live with at home. You're going to ask a question. What can I do to be a better partner in this relationship? Well, you know, it's funny. I do this now in my classes. So, again, I've had probably over 1,000 people do this with their partner. I get so many funny answers. One woman sends a note back to her husband, says, who's this intended for? I'm your wife. Another one said, who's stolen my husband's cell phone? Then I get the, are you drunk? Or are you having an affair? I mean, I get all kinds of crazy answers.
We got some strange ones back this morning already.
Yeah, we got some this morning. The one poor man that broke the record, his wife had 17 suggestions for improvement. sometimes the husband or wife will call and say, are you sick? And they're just figured you must have a problem.
There's something wrong.
Must be something wrong with you because you seem like you're interested in trying to be better in our relationship. You know, who am I talking to here?
That's
right. Can't be the person I married.
That's right.
Well, get in the habit of asking, how can I be a better, and then listen. And by the way, don't just ask at work, ask at home. If you're a parent, ask your kid, what can I do to be better as a parent? What can I do to be a better son or daughter? When my daughter Kelly was 11 and my son Brian was 9, I began asking my kids a question, how can I be a better parent? Probably asking the question is to get an answer. My daughter Kelly said, Daddy, you travel a lot. That's not what bothers me. What bothers me is the way you act when you come home. You talk on the phone, you watch sports, you don't spend much time with me. And she said, one time it's Saturday and you've been gone for 2 weeks. And I want to go to a party at my friend's house and Mommy didn't let me go to that party. I had to stay home and spend time with you. And then she said, you spend no time with me. That was not right. What could I say? I said, thank you. Daddy's going to try to do better. I said, I'm going to keep track of how many days I can spend 4 hours with my family. 1991, 92 days. 1992, 110. 1993, 131. 1994, 135. I made more money a year, spent 135 days, 4 hours with my family, than a year spent 20 days. What I learned? San Diego Chargers don't really care about me. And you mentioned the Tennessee Titans. Not much reason for you to care about them.
I think a bunch of people just hung up.
Well, January 1, 1995, now the kids are teenagers. I look at my kids, say, kids, 135 days, 4 hours with Dad. What goal this year? How about 150? They both go, no, Daddy, you've overachieved. My son said 50 is a better target. They both voted for a massive cutback of old Dad. I learned a good lesson. When they're little, it's good to do this because they need us. They get older, it's important because we need them. I was teaching a class for the Kaiser Permanente Company, a large hospital company in California. A woman in the class named Trudy Treiner, in front of 1,000 people, she raised her hand. She said, you know, there's always something you've left out. She said, I've read all your books. I've been to every class you've done. There's something you've always left out. She said, teach people to do this with their parents. She said, I went to your class, and I asked, after your class, I asked my daughter, 17, how could I be a better mother? And we had such a nice talk. Then she said, my daughter asked me, how can I be a better daughter? She said, that was so nice. She said, I ought to asked my own mother. So she called her mother and said, what can I do to be a better daughter? She said, my mother said, Daddy's dead. I live alone in the country. Every day I take a long walk up the road to go to the mailbox. And she said, almost every day, there's nothing in my mailbox. And every day that makes me sad. She said, as your mother, it'd mean so much to me if you'd send me a picture, a card or something. So when I would walk to the mailbox, I'd find something in the mailbox. She started sending her mother little pictures and cards every day. What'd that mean to her mother? A lot. What did it cost her? Nothing. Sent me an email a couple of years ago and said my mother just died. The last thing her mother told her was thank you for doing that. Well, if your parents are alive, this is a nice thing to do for three reasons. One is good for them. They'll be proud you cared enough to ask. Even if they say you don't need to change, they'll be proud you cared. Number two is good for you. What's the number one regret kids have when mom and dad die? Why didn't I thank them for all the nice things they did to help me? Why is that so critical of them? And number three, if you do have little kids, it's good for your little kids. Why? Those old people you're calling up on the telephone, guess what? You're going to be those old people. You want your kid calling you up on the telephone? Little kid's not going to listen to what you say. That little kid's going to watch what you do. So get in the habit of asking that question and challenge yourself. Who do I need to ask that question? How can I be a better two? Then listen to people in a non-defensive way. Think about what they learned and thank them and try not to punish the messenger. And then respond. And how do I teach people to respond to feedback? Positive, simple, focused, and fast. Say, you know, they ask a bunch of people for feedback. I got this 360 feedback. Here's what I learned. Here's what I feel real good about. Talk about the positives. And then say, here's something I want to improve. And I just say, pick something that comes from your heart that you really believe you want to improve. And then, for example, I want to be a better listener. Give me ideas. And then ask for ideas for the future more than feedback about the past. And then listen in a non-defensive way. Don't promise to do everything. Leadership's not a popularity contest, but thank people and say, look, I'm going to follow up with you and do what I can, and then involve them, focus on changing and follow up. And I did a research study called Leadership as a Contact Sport. If you'd like a copy of it, send me an email, marshall@marshallgoldsmith.com. We have a study, 86,000 people from 8 major companies from around the world, and it pretty much shows that this stuff works. Now, Joe, you haven't seen this yet. We've got a new study now with 248,000 people from around the world where we do a geographic comparison, and this stuff works everywhere in the world. There's no country it doesn't work. The best scores in the world, by the way, are in Asia. And, again, scores are good everywhere, but in Asia the scores are even better than they are here. So it's something pretty much always works. Ask, listen, think, thank, involve those people and change, and then follow up. Follow up and stick with it. And if you do that stuff, you tend to get better.
Yeah, if you just ask the question and then ignore the answer.
It doesn't help.
It doesn't mean anything.
No, you have to do something.
That's exactly right. So when we get to the question and answer period, for any of you who texted your spouse or significant other, if you got an answer, we want to hear from you. What about the
Mary,
daily? Yes.
Just for everybody's information. Before the call started, Marshall had me text to my wife and ask her the same question. And I'm sitting here waiting to get a response, and I've not gotten one yet. She's still typing. I just want to share a little bit of my own coaching experience. I spent a lot of time on the road in stores, and it was so much fun just coaching people, not only – I mean, you get coached often, but you also can coach others, and in coaching others can be a very rewarding experience. We spent time in a couple of hours in a store and then drove to another store and spent time in between, and I've spent time coaching and talking to the people that were with me and the people that were in the stores, and just listening to them. And Marshall talked earlier about the importance of seeking to improve all the time. And I found that by simply asking questions about that kind of thing, you know, what, can we sell more of this? Why isn't this selling? What's good here? What does a customer say about this? If you keep probing and asking questions that lead to improvement, people will think, well, I'm going to keep improving as opposed to be satisfied with the status quo. So coaching can be a very rewarding process when you are successfully coaching people, as Marshall does all the time professionally, and you turn around and you watch people be successful. That can be a very, very self-motivating, very rewarding thing personally, as well as helping the individual or individuals you're coaching get better. I just want to share that little piece of my experience.
Sure. Very good. You know, let me give everybody just a very simple business coaching technique. And if you go to YouTube, this will be my – I do a video pretty much every week, and I'm doing little videos every week. So this is this week's video, and it's called the six-question process for business coaching. You can either get it from my website, or you can go to YouTube, www.marshallgoldsmith.com, or I can say YouTube, or the Thinkers 50. I'm one of the top 50 business thinkers websites. The six-question process is a great tool to help people as coaches. About every 2 or 3 months, what you do is you have a one-on-one dialogue with each of your direct reports and go over six basic questions. Question number one, where are we going? Say, here's where I see us going as a team. Where do you think we should be going? And have a dialogue. Question two, where are you going? Here's where I see you and your part of the business going. Then ask the question, where do you think you should be going? Another dialogue. Number three, doing well. Here's what I see you doing well, and then ask that person a question, what are you proud of? What do you think you're doing well? That's a great question, because sometimes as a leader, we don't recognize people, not out of maliciousness, but out of ignorance. Mm-hmm. That person might say, well, you know, Joe, I know you had that presentation, and my team spent all weekend putting it together, and I know it went well. I'm so proud of them. And then I might say, yeah, I didn't understand that. I didn't realize the sacrifice you made. That's great. I should recognize them. Then number four, suggestions for the future. I'd say, here's some ideas I'd have might help you get better in the future. And then ask the person a question. Imagine you were the coach for you. What idea would you have? Now, Joe, you met my friend George Boris. George just retired as CEO of Toyota Financial Services, a wonderful man. George said he was shocked at how much he learned by asking this question. If you were the coach for you, what idea would you have? He thought people would just say fluffy things like, you know, I work too hard and all that. He said he was surprised. More than half the time, he said their ideas were better than his. And he ended up saying, let's just do what you think is the best thing to do. And then question number five, how can I help? And then question six, what ideas have for me to help me get better? And then the key to making the process work, the six-question process, called mutual responsibility. What you say to the person is, every 2 or 3 months, I'm going to go through these six basic questions as a coach for you. If you ever at any time feel lack of clarity, uncertainty as to roles, need feedback, whatever, I want you to take responsibility to talk to me. If I do my job every couple months and you do your job in between, there's no reason we should have any problems with alignment, coaching, or feedback. I've done this with six CEOs and it's worked 6 times out of 6, so I've never seen it fail.
Excellent. And for those of you who didn't catch that, his Thinkers 50 blog has a video clip every week that comes with an idea, and the six questions is the one from this week.
Mm-hmm.
So related but a little bit different is the daily question process.
Now, I love the daily question process. I'm now going to teach you something that takes about 2 minutes a day. It's free. It's going to help you get better at almost anything. And half of you that start this process, you're going to quit within 2 weeks. And you're not going to quit because it doesn't work. You'll quit because it does work. Now, what is the daily question process? I want you to get out an Excel spreadsheet. And on one column, you're going to write a list of questions that you're going to challenge yourself with every day. And every question has to be answered with yes, a no, or a number. Yes,
and
no.
Not too many. Fewer is probably better than
many or few as you want. Many or few as you want. Well, I do 32, but there's nothing magic. And, you know, you can do as many or few as you want to do. And I'm going to share some of mine. Now, if you want all my daily questions, send me an email, marshall@marshallgoldsmith.com. I'll send you the whole list of them. And I'll send you an article about this process. Here's the key, though. My questions are in no way intended to be your questions. The idea behind this exercise, you write your own questions. Why? Your values are your business. And it's not my place to tell you what you want to be in life. My place is to help you be the person you want to be, not to tell you who that person is. I'm going to share some of mine, though, just by matter of course. One question for me is every day, how many times yesterday did you try to prove you were right when it wasn't worth it? Kind of hard for the old professor not to be right all the time. I almost seldom ever get a zero on that question. How about you, Joe? How about that old CEO? You ever tried to be right a little bit too much?
Yep, certainly have.
Another question for me is, how many angry or destructive comments did you make about people yesterday? And then just a bunch of simple questions. Did you say or do something nice for your wife? Say or do something nice for your son? Or say or do something nice for your daughter, son-in-law?
Mother.
Yeah, and then a good question, how many minutes did you walk and push-ups and sit-ups and questions about diet and exercise? Just a lot of great questions about life. My friend Jim Moore does this. I do this every day, by the way. I have a woman call me up every day. Her name's Kate. I pay her to call me. She called me this morning, called me tomorrow, calls me every day. Every day she just listens to me read 32 questions that I wrote and provide 32 answers that I wrote. Now, somebody asked me, why do you pay somebody to do this? Don't you know the theory about how to change behavior? I wrote the theory about how to change behavior. That's why I have somebody do it. I know how hard it is. It's not easy for me. On American Airlines alone, I have over 11 million frequent flyer miles. At one level, that sounds kind of funny. That's an excuse to be out of shape and divorced. And you can make a lot of excuses with 11 million frequent flyer miles, but you know what? Those excuses don't matter. Well, it's hard for me, hard for you, hard for any of us to keep stuff in our head. This is a great process to help you do it. I'll tell you, though, it's very easy to understand in theory. Most people can't do it. You know why? It's hard to look in the mirror every day. It's a whole lot easier for me to find my problems where? Out there in somebody else than it is to find my problems in myself. My friend Jim would tell you to save his life. Why? One of his questions was, are you currently updated on your physical exam? He said, no, the first 90 days he did it. After 90 days, he said, this is embarrassing. I've got to get the dumb exam or quit asking a question. He got the dumb exam. Doctor said, you have cancer. And he's going to be fine. The doctor also said, had you waited 7 months, you'd be dead. He knew he should have got an exam. He's 65 years old. He's chief learning officer of 3 multi-billion dollar companies. He's not a stupid man. He knew he should have done it. He just didn't do it. Well, you do this daily question thing every day. You got this mirror staring you back. You're staring in this mirror every day. What you learn is hard to do. Now, I'm sure almost everybody listens to me. You work in a company, you got these values plaques on the wall, these fancy plaques about values and customers and all that stuff and people and quality. Those are what I call talk values. Those are talk values. You want to know your real values? You write down that daily question, fill out that little test every day on yourself, and at the end of the week, that Excel spreadsheet gives you a scorecard. If you do this every day, you know what you learn, a hard lesson. All these values are real easy to talk. You're just hard to live. And you do this every day, you realize, man, this stuff is tough. It's not tough to talk. It's just tough to live. This is a great process, by the way. It can help you get better at anything. I want to give you a warning in advance, though. It's not an easy process. Not an easy process. Mary, what's next?
Well, we've introduced this with each one of our signature classes, and we have people from the very first class in 2006 who are still having a conversation with their peer partner every day.
Eight years later.
Right. Having a huge difference, making a huge difference. Okay, let's talk a little bit.
By the way, I got an email. I got an email this morning, and somebody said that changed my life.
Awesome.
Changed my life. He said, you know, where he really changed his life, he said, was he asked one question: how many minutes a day do I spend with each child? And he said, you know what? I really was ignoring my children and. When I started measuring it, he said, you know, I'd be tired maybe at the end of the day. I think, well, I'll do it tomorrow. But then he said, at zero, it's hard to look at that zero. Say, apathetic is a zero. He said, I can do better than zero. And sometimes to that kid, 10 minutes is a big deal. 10 minutes is certainly better than zero.
Because the average is?
Yeah, the average American father spends 7 to 15 minutes a week in a meaningful dialogue with the average American child. So, you know, It's not hard to beat the average.
You can beat that average, yes. So, concept, feed forward, not feedback. We hear so much about feedback.
Well, one term that I invented with my friend John Katzenbach is a concept called feed forward, and it's one of the essence of how I teach coaching. I'll describe how I just taught in the class right here. I get up in front of the group and say, we're going to practice something called feed forward, not feedback. In feed forward, you're going to be two roles. Role number one is called learn as much as I can. Are there smart people in this room, yes or no? And everybody says, yeah. Well, and you say, would you like to learn from these people? And say, yes. Well, this is your chance. Role two is called help as much as I can. And I say, are there nice people in this room? They say, sure. I say, well, would you like to help these people? I say, yeah. So you're either learning, which is good, or you're helping, which is good. In feed forward, what are the rules? Rule one, no feedback about the past. We spend too much time talking about the past. How many of us have been impressed with our husband, wife, or partner's near photographic memory of our previous sins, which have been documented and will be shared with us in a repetitive and annoying way? Well, you know what? We can't change the past anyway. Rule one, no feedback about the past. And rule two, can't judge or critique ideas. You need to treat the idea like a gift. So when people give you an idea, you say, thank you. You don't put them down. You don't say, that's a good idea, that's a bad idea, I already do that, that'll never work. And what people do is they'll say, for example, my name is Jim, I want to be a good listener, give me a couple of ideas. People to give them ideas, I say, thank you, my name is Mary, I want to do a good job at giving recognition, give me a couple of ideas. Thank you, shake hands and talk to somebody else. At the end of the exercise, I say, give me some words to describe this exercise. And people invariably say it's positive, useful, helpful, or even fun. Then I say, well, what's the last word you think to describe any feedback activity? Fun. Why do people think this is fun and positive and useful and helpful? And by the way, this is around the world. I've done this exercise. Hundreds of thousands of people from around the world. They almost always say positive, useful, helpful, fun. And I say, well, it's talking about what we can change, not what we can't. And it's helping. It's not judging. It's two ways, not one way. And I learned I can learn from everybody, and I don't have to be better than others to help others. Why don't we just be two humans helping each other? So it's a wonderful process, and it's kind of the key to my whole coaching approach. Again, if you like an article about it, send me an email, marshall@marshallgoldsmith.com. Be happy to send you an article describing it. Or also, if you go to my website, there's video about that on the website as well.
So where can I get more information? I know that you have a ton of resources on your Marshall Goldsmith Library.
Hmm. Yeah, I give all my resources away. So you may copy, share, download, duplicate, use in church, charity, nonprofit, business, use any of my materials any way you wish. My website is www.marshallgoldsmith.com. It'll take you to the Marshall Goldsmith Library website. There you can find all kinds of videos, articles, all kinds of stuff. You want to get on my mailing list, I'll be happy to send you my Thinkers 50 video. I send out one every week.
And they are wonderful.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And they're all about 3 minutes to 10 minutes in that sort of short video time range. And so anyway, I think it's just I try to help people as much as I can and just give everything away. People have been nice to me, and a lot of people help me, and they never ask for anything back. So I thought if I can, help a few people, it's a nice thing for me to do. Maybe one or two people, they send me an email and just say I have a little bit better life. As I've grown older, I think what's important to me is not just so much the big things. It's kind of dawned on me I'm not going to cure cancer, or I'm going to work on the eradication of poverty on Earth with my friend Alan Mulally, but, I don't know if we're going to maybe totally succeed. But as I've grown older, what's important is little things. Somebody like to send me that email and says, thank you, it helped me be a better husband or better father, better person, better boss, better anything. That's nice. That always makes me feel like it maybe helped the world be a little bit better.
Well, a couple of things about what you do. A, you give your resources away. B, you've made it seem so possible for us to help ourselves that we don't have to go out and spend hundreds of dollars for a coach, although I do have a question about that that came in online. But there are things we can do. We can get a partner so we've got some accountability. And it's just getting in the right mindset, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not rocket science.
Oh, no, nothing that I do is I'm from Valley Station, Kentucky, so everything I do is pretty straightforward and simple stuff. I'm not a believer in the big fancy words or concepts because one of my old teachers was Dr. Paul Hersey, and he always said, should never use fancy words or concepts because who are you trying to impress then?
Exactly.
You're not trying to talk to people. You're just trying to impress people then.
Exactly.
So I always try to be as practical as I can. If I said anything, it's hard to understand. It's just I didn't say it well.
So if you have questions, and we hope you do, we know you have questions. It's just that we hope you'll send them. *7 if you're on the phone. If you're online, write your question and then hit send. We do have one online question and one online comment. We got a message from someone who had texted to his wife, "What can I do to be a better spouse?" And the answer he got back was, "I hope you aren't driving," which I love. Joe, have you heard from Dorothy?
No, I'm not. I just went back, as you mentioned, I went back to my phone and looked at it. I still have the question posted here, but she has not responded yet. She keeps asking.
This is a little worrisome, don't you think?
Oh, it's funny. So what's the other question we got?
The other question we have is, I really could use some leadership coaching, and how would you suggest if I am going to go out and look for someone outside? How do I find somebody that's right for me?
Well, what I would do in looking for a coach is somewhat counterintuitive. Our instinctive reaction is the coach says, what do you need help with? And you tell him what you need help with. I wouldn't do that. I would ask the coach, what do you do best? And then the coach says, well, what do you mean? I'd say, well, you can't coach people to do everything. Specifically, what do you do best? Well, if what they do best is matching what you need, that's a good thing. If what they do best is not exactly what you need, that's a bad thing.
Right.
And if they say they do 20 things well, that's a little dubious. So in my case, you see, my whole area of expertise is helping already successful leaders achieve positive long-term change in behavior. So if you do a Google search, in quotes, helping space successful space leaders, end of quotes, the first 500 hits, 450 are me. That's what I do. Well, I'm the specialist on that. I don't do getting organized. I don't do how to give speeches. I don't do strategy. I don't do marketing. Well, I try to focus on what I do well. I think when you're trying to hire a coach, make sure that you get somebody whose area of expertise matches yours. A friend of mine runs the world's largest coaching network. It's called Coach Source. So if anybody's interested in hiring a coach, send me an email. I'll be happy to refer you to him. He's got the biggest list in the world of coaches that he recommends to people. May not work out, but there's no downside anyway. And the other thing is don't work with anybody you don't feel good about. So you need to, in your heart, feel like, yeah, this person looks like he'd be a good person for me to work with.
Chemistry needs to be right.
Yeah.
We will get a request from time to time for someone, for a coach, and we'll try to suggest two or three people and ask them to talk to all of them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as you said, you've got to have the right expertise, but also the fit, the chemistry has to be right.
Here's another question. Do people really change behavior, or are they merely perceived as changing because they do all the follow-up? And the answer to that question is kind of the opposite of what you might think. It's much easier to change behavior than it is to change perception. Changing perception is very hard. One of the best research principles in psychology is called cognitive dissonance theory. We all view people in a manner that's consistent with our previous stereotype. So if I have a stereotype of you that says you're a bad listener, I'm going to look for a bad listener until I see it. Let me give you a simple example to illustrate my point. Let's imagine your problem is, and I'm your coworker, and your problem is you make too many destructive comments about others. I picked that because it sounds so simple. You think, well, that's easy to fix. Just quit doing it. Well, not so simple. You go 7 months, you don't talk to me, you don't do any follow-up, but you don't make any bad comments. 7 months later, you say, stupid SOBs in finance, idiot bean counters, how do we get anything done in this company that's run by a bunch of stupid accountants? I hear you. My first reaction is, this person's never changed. That one negative comment will trigger my previous stereotype, this person never changed. Situation B, you talk to me. You say, coworker Marshall, I want to be a great team player, not make bad comments. Please give me some ideas to help me. Now, I don't necessarily believe you're going to change, but I listen. I kind of go with the plan. What happens, though, 2 months later when you say, you know, co-worker Marshall, it's been 2 months. 2 months ago, I say, it's been 2 months. I said I want to be great at being a good team player. Now, give me ideas. Now, I think, you know, I never thought about it. You've done good. Keep it up. It's been 4 months. Good job. Keep it up. 6 months. I say, you know, I didn't think you'd change. You really worked hard. I appreciate it. 7 months, stupid SOBs in finance. I say, you know, you shouldn't have said that. You went 7 months without saying that. The other person says, I'm sorry. You're right. I want to apologize. Situation A, did behavior change? Yes. Did perception change? No. Situation B, did behavior change? Yes. Perception change? Yes. In leadership, it doesn't matter what we say. It only matters what people hear. And in life, we don't see what's there. We see what we think is there. Mm-hmm. Now, I want you to look at your watches or clocks, and if you're not around one, get out your text and look up Roman numeral watch face. What's that Roman numeral 10 look like? Well, everybody says X. They say, what's a 4 look like? And a huge majority of people say IV. 95% of all watches and clocks, Roman numeral 4 is not an IV. It's 4 eyes. And people, I've done this to people loaned it 40 years. They can't see it. Why? In life, we don't see what's there. We see what we think is there.
We see what we think is there.
Yeah, we don't see what's there. And I've done this again. You believe that there's supposed to be an IV. You can look at the watch for 30 years and never notice it.
Exactly.
Okay.
We have another question. Do you keep track of the time spent with grandchildren?
I don't have any grandchildren yet. Yeah. Yet. I've got hopefully two on the way. So maybe say, how do you get two on the way? Twins. So I've got two on the way. So I definitely would do that. By the way, I've done some fascinating research with my daughter, who is obviously is going to be hopefully the source of these grandchildren. And I've done some fascinating research with my daughter on the topic of happiness and meaning. And we asked people, what in life makes you happy and what in life's meaningful for you? And what we find out is, really on most things, it's very different. For example, gardening. Some people say gardening really makes me happy and it's meaningful. Some people say it's meaningful, but it doesn't make me happy. Some people say it makes me happy and it's not meaningful. And some people say I hate gardening. It's not happy or meaningful. There's nothing magic about gardening. It's what does gardening mean to you. The one area, going back to your question, when we say describe something in life that's happy for you and you feel to be meaningful, spending time with the grandchildren is the one area I have never seen get a low score.
Wow.
That one is always right at the top. Not spending time with the children, by the way. Spending time with the grandchildren. Now, I imagine probably the young grandchildren, once they hit teenagers, maybe that's not so good either.
Probably not. So we have one other online question, and
sure.
That is, so I'm the boss of a number of people who do practice winning too much and who do add too much value, and it doesn't seem to occur to them on their own that they should stop doing that. How is the best way to suggest it?
Well, I always think it's great to start with yourself. And I would say, here's one thing I want to improve, and get some input from them, and they get to see you be a good role model. Then the second thing is, you just say to them, here's one thing I want you to work on. And they say, well, I don't think I have a problem. You know what to say? I'm not saying you're bad. I'm just saying I want you to work on this and do a good job in the future. And then it's hard to argue with it. It's an important topic. And then you say, I want you to get input and talk to people and say, I want to do a great job of this. Give me ideas and then tell me what you learn and then talk to people and follow up. That's what I do as a coach. My coaching is very simple. I work with a CEO or could be CEO of a huge company. Then first thing is, there's no arguing in my coaching process. The cost to my clients hiring me is their time, so I'm not there to waste their time. I'm the coach of Ian Reed, the CEO of Pfizer. I mean, it's the world's largest drug company. What's his time worth? He doesn't need me to waste his time. So I don't waste time. I get to the point, and then I say, all right, here's what's required. It's not a vote. You have to get confidential feedback. You have to pick important behavior to improve. You have to talk to people. You have to follow up. You have to get measured. You have to follow up with me. You get measured twice, and you achieve significant improvement at the right behaviors, judged by the right people. I get paid. And I always say, I don't get paid because I'm a good coach. I get paid because you're a good client. Don't make it about me. It's not my life. It's your life. Well, then if the person isn't the CEO, I get their boss involved, and they agree, yeah, these are the right people, and these are the right behaviors, and it's worth the money. So I follow up with them, and we measure and follow up and measure. So that's kind of how I coach people. And again, it's a pretty much proven process. If they stick with the plan, take it seriously, follow up, they get better. Now, when does my coaching not work? It doesn't work if people don't care. I'm not an expert on changing people who don't care. If they don't care, I'm not going to help you. It doesn't work with people who are not given a chance. Sometimes big companies, they kind of write people off. They don't really have a chance, but they don't have the guts to fire them. And this fake coaching process, it's not really coaching. It's seek and destroy. And then also, it doesn't work with people who have intellectual or technical problems. So, for example, a pharmaceutical company called me up and said, we want you to coach Dr. X. I said, great, what's his problem? They said, he's not updated on recent medical technology. I said, neither am I. Well, I can't make a bad doctor a good doctor, a bad scientist a good scientist. Behavioral coaching doesn't help somebody has a wrong strategy. If you're going in the wrong direction, this just helps you get there faster. And then finally, sometimes just the wrong person, the wrong job. In those cases, and it doesn't mean the person's bad or the job is bad. In this case, they just need to be in a different job. So that's when does it work? If it's behavioral, they're willing to try and they're given a chance. My process always works. Those conditions don't exist. Don't use this process.
Right. And I think I've heard you say this before, but how many engagements have you not been paid for?
Not too many. I get paid about 90, 95% of the time.
Exactly.
Yeah, most of the time I get paid. Over the years, you know, you just learn to kind of sniff this out, and you figure this not getting paid thing is kind of painful, so let's just don't do that anymore. better to get paid, given the choices, yes.
*7 if you're on the phone. Write in your question and hit send if you're online. Joe, what do you have to add?
Well, I was reflecting back on one of the things Marshall was talking about earlier. When you ask people for commentary about your performance, or you ask them for ideas about how to get better, it's so I've seen so many situations where you start arguing with that person right away, and I like to use the expression "don't shoot the messenger." Just always remember that anybody who's giving you feedback, you've got to listen to. All the time I spend in the tractor supply stores, if somebody's giving you feedback about how to make things better, the only thing you want to say to them is thank you very much. And then in the cases where that suggestion makes a difference in the performance of that store or the company, go celebrate it afterwards. Pat them on the back. But it's very important not to argue with anybody giving you constructive feedback.
Yeah, you know, Joe, I'm glad you brought this up, this business of don't shoot the messenger. It's fine that you bring this up with the group, and you point out yourself as a good role model in that area, how you've done this yourself without shooting the messenger. Now, I'm going to give you a case study about shooting the messenger that, let's see how you did with your lovely wife. Now, here's a case study. You come home from work, you've had a hard day. You get in the car, you're driving off to the store. Lots of traffic. Cars are cutting in front of you. People are honking their horns. You drive a little further. And then your wife here in the front seat goes, Joe, look out, there's a red light up ahead. Now, Joe, did you say, thank you, Dorothy, I appreciate that input, or did you say, I know there's a red light, don't you think I can see? I know how to drive this car, why don't you let me drive? Now, Joe, have you ever used that bad option B before?
I assume we have to be honest at this conference call. The answer is occasionally yes.
Now, Joe, I'm confused. You just told everybody here with that preachy little sermon of yours why it's important not to shoot the messenger and ask for that honest input. I'm confused. Now, what made you yell at that fine Dorothy in the front seat? By the way, what was the cost of her saying there's a red light ahead? That didn't cost anybody anything. I could have saved your life, her life, and the lives of other innocent people. Now, what should you say, Joe, when your fine wife tells you something that can save lives and cost nothing? What should you say to that woman?
I say, sweetheart, thank you so much, and I love you to pieces.
And how could I be a better spouse, by the way?
Okay.
All right. Any other questions?
Hey, Mary, there's one more question online. Here we go. Any suggestions on how a subordinate can coach the boss? Is it
Excellent.
Possible?
That's a great question.
Now, why is that a great question? Because I have an answer. Now, yeah, a bad question is one I don't have an answer. That's a good question. Now, also, if you want the written version of this, send me an email, marshall@marshallgoldsmith.com, and just write down effectively influencing decision makers. I'll send you the whole write-up on this because I've written a whole article about it. It's one of my favorite articles, too. How do you influence people when you don't have direct line authority? Well, again, I was on the board of the Peter Drucker Foundation for 10 years, and he taught me many great lessons. Here's one of the great lessons he taught me, and if you just understand this lesson, you'll be better at influencing people up, down, and sideways. He said, every decision in life is made by the person who has power to make the decision. Make peace with that. Make peace. Not the best person, the smartest person, the right person. Every decision made by that person. Make peace. He said, our mission in life is to make a positive difference, not to prove we're smart, not to prove we're right. If you need to influence that other person and they have the power to make the decision, one word to define that person, customer. One word to define yourself, salesperson. It's not their job to buy, it's your job to sell. Sell what you can sell. Change what you can change and make peace with what you can't change. Very few of us in life ever deeply understand that lesson. It is such a valuable lesson. The decision is made by the decision maker. Make peace. And you can't believe how much money I've made as a coach. This is a third of my business sometimes. One company is owned by a KKR, a private equity firm. They own a company. You know what the CEO says? Well, they can't tell me what to do. obviously he'd never been a CEO before.
How long do they last?
Well, no, they're just going to get rid of him. But then they said, well, it cost us a few million to get rid of this guy. We'll try to help him out here with the coach.
Try to fix him.
Yeah, help him out. So they hired me to help him. I'll say his name is Joe. I said, I go talk to him. He said, well, they can't tell me what to do. I said, now, Joe, guys, that's very good. You have a fine job title, CEO. I said, that's a nice job, CEO, very impressive. I said, see, they have job titles. It's called owner. CEO is good, owner is better. He said, they can't tell me what to do. I said, let me correct you there, buddy. Yes, I can. And they just did. And they didn't ask you to do anything immoral, illegal, and unethical. They just told you what to do. And, you know, you're cashing that check at the end of the month. You know what? You can salute the flag and go do it. Now, I said, if you do exactly what I tell you, you might get saved here. And if you don't do exactly what I tell you, I got to go back and talk to Daddy and Mommy and say, you know, I can't help little Junior. So, you know, what's going to be, son? And he said, well, let's just try this. Well, you know, he's a good guy. He didn't mean any harm. He's had a little brain death. And he got much better. And one time I didn't get paid, though. It was the same point. And, Joe, you'll appreciate this story. The board of directors, they can't tell me what to do. He's a CEO. Board of directors, they can't tell me what to do. Same thing. I talked to him. I said, now, let me help you. You see, the board of directors, they don't report to you. You see, you report to them. By the way, both these guys had MBAs from Harvard. I wonder what they teach them in school sometime, right? Yeah. And I said, you know, no, the board, you see, you report to the board. They represent the ownership of the company. They don't report to you. So let's be clear here. And then, you know, he got better for a while, but then the board votes 10-0 and tells him to do something. You know, he told the board, I'm not sure I want to do that. They call me up and they say, well, Marshall, thank you for trying, but, you know, this ain't going to work. You can't talk to him, of course. We're going to see him Tuesday. Then he calls up. You know, he said, oh, the board guys are coming over Tuesday. I wonder what they want to talk about. Idiot.
Really?
Oh, goodbye. Right. So, great learning point. Our mission isn't to prove we're smart. Our mission is to make a positive difference. And, Joe, you were a CEO. You always got a boss.
That's right.
Everybody's got a boss.
We have one more question.
You got two of them. I got two. Go ahead.
Go ahead. We got a couple more. Go ahead.
All right. I'm in a new executive team and want to make sure we sustain. Can you comment on practices to building a cohesive team in a room full of six leaders?
Another great question. I love these questions, right? Mm-hmm. Why? Another answer. Send me an email if you want to write up on this one called Team Building Without Time Wasting. This is another one I published an article about. But the nice thing about me is when you ask me questions, I've published several hundred articles. So in most cases, you don't need to write down every word I say because you send me an email, I send you an article about it. But Team Building Without Time Wasting, I'll give you the gist of it. You get up in front of that team and say, on a 1 to 10 scale, how well are we doing and working together as a team? How well do we need to be doing? Give everybody a little piece of paper. They write it down. The average team says we are a 5.8 and we want to be an 8.7. Then you say, all right, let's all give me a couple things. If everybody did better at this, improve teamwork, and you have them prioritize. So let's say they all say, listen, each person practices feed forward with every other team member and says, okay, we're all going to work on listening. Other than listening, give me one thing to help me be a great team player. They take notes, have every person pick one behavior to improve. So let's say I pick recognition. Then you have a very simple three-question follow-up process about once a month. Every team member talks to every other team member that says something like this. You know, Mr. Team Member, we're all working on listening. Give me one idea to help me be a better listener. I'm working on recognition. Give me one idea to help me do a great job of that. And number three, I just want to be a great team player. Give me one idea to help me. Follow up, a very simple mini-survey measure, follow-up measure. You get more long-term improvement in team building doing what I just described, and you'll get shipping people off to the woods for a month where they can climb trees, but no follow-up measurement and discipline. So, yeah, very good question.
And it's a great article.
Send me an email. I'll send you a copy of the article.
Remember,
and by the way, also, I have the tape on that, too.
Okay.
So, yeah, if you go to my underwear, it says Coaching for Behavioral Change, that series of tapes. The team building one is in that series.
Many, many resources. So feel free to use them, share them, give them to other people, suggest that other people go to the same site. Marshall is very liberal and free with his resources, and we appreciate that. Joe, I think our time is up.
Our time is up, and I want to thank you all for joining us today. Our next program will be on Monday, November 3rd. Marshall, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And I'm sorry I wasn't able to see you in person, but I will next time around. And again, thanks everybody for joining us today. See you next month. Bye-bye.
Very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.